if you got to use retardant, if that's the best tool that you have, or even a last resort sometimes, then yeah, use retardant.
Officials work to protect the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge from a 20,000-acre fire. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Anchorage scientist who thinks ancient cancer can help us understand the modern disease.
Can you imagine what it would be like to document cancer from the last 10,000 years?
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
An Army Inspector General found leaders of the Alaska National Guard did not cover up any reports of sexual assault and harassment. At least that's how the Inspector General's Office for the Defense Department explained it in a letter today to Senator Lisa Murkowski. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Senator Murkowski said in a written statement she's withholding further comment until she gets a chance to see the IG report itself. She requested the investigation last year after hearing from two guard chaplains who claimed senior leaders were turning a blind eye to sexual assaults. The one-page letter to Murkowski says the Army Inspector General's investigation ended last month. It described a narrowly focused investigation that found no wrongdoing by guard brass. That's good news for General Thomas Katkus, top officer at the Alaska Guard. Major Candace Olmsted, his spokeswoman, says Katkus will be following up.
He's not seen the full report yet, but he is going to be requesting a copy of the report so that he can see what areas they found where we can improve upon.
The report, as the letter describes it, is centered on two questions: whether the Alaska Guard allowed a management climate that wasn't conducive to reporting sexual assaults, and whether officials tried to cover up any accusations. The letter to Murkowski says the Army IG didn't find evidence of a cover-up. It also says Guard commanders didn't identify any concerns about the reporting of sexual assaults during climate sensing sessions with the troops. The letter confirms some of the broad outlines of the case, though not the details. It says the Guard's sexual assault response coordinator received 11 allegations of sexual assault since 2012. They were forwarded to civilian police, but only two were substantiated and none was prosecuted in court. The letter says General Katkus delivered administrative punishment on the only two cases he could. He discharged one of the accused from guard service and initiated the departure of another. A third DOD oversight branch, the Directorate of Investigations of Senior Officials, reviewed the Army IG report and concurred, the letter says. Olmsted, the Guard spokeswoman, says 9 alleged sexual assaults by Alaska Guardsmen have been reported to the Sexual Assault Response Coordinator since 2009. The IG letter says 11 and just in the last 3 years. Olmsted says it may be because the coordinator helps and takes reports from Guard victims regardless of whom they accuse.
Their 11 alleged sexual assault incidents would have to also include incidents where the perpetrator was not a member of the Alaska National Guard.
One more investigation into the Alaska National Guard is still underway. It's by the Office of Complex Investigations, part of the National Guard Bureau. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The fire that's been burning on the Kenai Peninsula since Monday has now burned more than 20,000 acres. The fire is still contained on the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. More than 200 firefighters and several aircraft are using water from nearby Tustamina Lake to control the blaze. Refuge Fire Management Officer Doug Newbold says water is preferred over chemical retardants in environmentally sensitive areas.
Fish especially, those are the aquatic resources are the thing we're trying to protect by not using retardant. However, We also, you know, understand and are fully supportive of the policy and the practice of protecting communities. And if you got to use retardant, if that's the best tool that you have at your disposal, or even a last resort sometimes, then yeah, use retardant.
Strong northerly winds that had sent smoke from the fire south toward Homer had died down by today. A thick blanket of smoke settled in the area from Sterling to Kenai, prompting Central Peninsula Hospital to suspend surgical operations for the day. The fire isn't threatening any substantial property, and no evacuation orders have been made. A fire near the village of Tyonic has grown to approximately 1,500 acres. Pete Buist is a fire information officer with the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center. He says most of the activity is at the north end of the fire, which has reduced the danger near Tyonic.
We're not completely out of the water there, but we are concerned this morning about Beluga and the power station there and the gas lines and, you know, oil and gas infrastructure that's there.
No evacuation is in effect for Beluga, and the evacuation for Tyonic was lifted this afternoon. Approximately 90 people and two helicopters are working to contain the fire. Cancer is often described as a modern disease, but the skeletal remains of our ancient ancestors are marked by the ravages of cancer. And an Anchorage scientist, who's a cancer survivor, thinks those prehistoric bones could hold clues to understanding how the disease works today. It's an emerging field, though, that has some critics. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
This is what happens when Katie Hunt tells people what she does for work.
I get a lot of head nodding and then confusion.
Hunt is a new kind of scientist. She studies ancient cancer. In 2012, she co-founded the Paleo-Oncology Research Organization. The group wants to develop standards for detecting and diagnosing cancer in ancient skeletons. Hunt is convinced tracking the evolution of the disease will help scientists understand modern cancer.
We basically have a lot of information from the last 70 years or so. But can you imagine what it would be like to document cancer from the last 10,000 years?
As a kid, Hunt was obsessed with archaeology. She filled binders with her favorite National Geographic stories on ancient worlds. At the end of her sophomore year in college in Washington State, Hunt went on her first dig in Egypt. She spent 5 weeks excavating a site in the Nile Delta where an ancient beer factory had been built inside a temple.
Because the priests were paid in beer, food and beer.
In the rubble of the beer factory, Hunt came across a single burial site. She carefully preserved a layer of pure white matting. Then she brushed away the dirt to reveal a partial skeleton from a woman who lived roughly 5,000 years ago. It was the moment she knew she wanted to study human remains.
And I got very excited, and it was just kind of this suddenly like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do in archaeology. This is why I'm so drawn to archaeology.
At the time, Hunt didn't even know the field of paleopathology existed, but she wanted to know more about how this woman lived and why she died. She went back and forth to Egypt and started learning how to study disease and trauma in ancient skeletons. Then life interrupted. At the end of the school year in 2009, Hunt had bloating and swelling in her stomach with some intense pain. She assumed it was a stress-induced ulcer.
Things just got so bad that I ended up going into the emergency room and they discovered the tumor.
After emergency surgery, doctors told Hunt she had a rare and aggressive type of ovarian cancer. She was just 22 years old. Hunt spent the summer enduring a series of marathon inpatient chemotherapy sessions, and the treatment worked. In October, a month after she finished chemotherapy, Hunt went back to Egypt for more field work. This time, she was working in the Valley of the Kings, analyzing the bones of several skeletons that suffered from a mysterious disease.
That was kind of that moment where I was like, oh yeah, what if cancer did exist in ancient societies? And if it did, how did they deal with it?
The skeletons didn't turn out to have cancer, but the experience prompted Hunt to write an undergraduate thesis showing cancer did exist in ancient times. Hippocrates wrote about it and even gave cancer its name. She wanted to turn that research into something more tangible and actually find cancer in skeletal remains. When the disease metastasizes to the bone, it leaves behind either holes or a buildup on the skeleton. Hunt enrolled in graduate school in paleopathology in England with a focus on ancient cancers.
Almost nothing had been done up to that point.
But there were some documented cases of cancer in skeletal remains. Hunt spent 2 years compiling every ancient cancer case study she could find into a database. In all, she came across 230 individuals who likely had cancer. Hunt wants to use that database to develop standards for diagnosing ancient cancers. She thinks paleo-oncology is key to tracing how cancer developed through big events in human history, like the transition to agricultural societies.
If we are able to document cancer through that time period, we might be able to see changes and how it was manifested in the human body. So tracing those and understanding the development of cancer through these big periods can really help us understand the causes of cancer today.
Hunt is getting a lot of attention for her work. She gave a TED Talk in Vancouver in March, and earlier this month, Fast Company put her on its list of the 100 most creative people in business. But she has critics, too.
Paleo-oncology is not going to help us to understand how to diagnose or treat modern cases of cancer. It just won't.
Robert Weinberg is a professor of cancer research at MIT who wrote a book on cancer biology. He's worried paleo-oncology will draw public funding away from research that holds more promise. He says a lot of cancers aren't preserved in skeletons.
Cancer is ultimately a disease of living tissues, and you can't study old bones to understand the origins of those cancers and how they actually formed.
Hunt says finding cellular evidence of cancer in skeletons is difficult, but she says newer technology, like next-generation DNA sequencing, is making it possible. And she expects new techniques in development will make it even easier down the road. Still, she understands the criticism and even welcomes it. But Hunt is determined to prove the potential of paleo-oncology. Right now, the field is tiny, like fit inside a compact car tiny.
So how many people?
Maybe 3 or 4 right now.
So you're saying you're one of 3 or 4 people in the world who are doing this?
Who are doing primarily this.
For now, Hunt is okay with tiny. She's riding a wave of momentum that has her dreaming big about what her organization can accomplish in the next few decades. She says her main goal is to persuade more archaeologists to think about the possibility of cancer when they're examining skeletal remains. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a pair of adventurers tackle the entire Aleutian chain in kayaks.
There's rocky landings, there's not very many beaches, there's no people, so if something goes wrong, you know, our longest stretch without people is 250 miles.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce. From healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants, Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
On the day that the summer's king salmon restrictions began, the Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group met to hash out the details of this summer fishing plans. As KYUK's Ben Matheson reports, managing a precarious king salmon run along 700 miles of river will be anything but simple.
After months of in-depth discussions leading up to the closures, 12 hours in, some working group members were still confused.
Going open to any kind of gear or drifting or what? You know, that's the confusion that we have.
Because, Bob Aloysius is from Kalskig. Part of that confusion comes from the different jurisdictions. Federal managers control the waters in the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge from the mouth to Aniak for the duration of the federal special action. The state manages below the mouth and above Aniak. There are a few key differences in regulations, especially around the Middle River. Unlike the federal rules, the state would allow drifting with 4-inch nets, and they do not plan to allow fish wheels during periods of king salmon conservation, whereas the feds would with certain protections for kings. That comes as bad timing to several Middle River villages who, through the Kuskokwim Native Association, are investing in fish wheels. Lisa Feiereisen is from Tsuwathpluk.
An absolute absolutely does not make sense that we could sit out there drifting with 4-inch mesh and keep our incidental kings when we're more than willing. We have purchased the material. We have people that are going to be monitoring the fish wheel, and we're releasing every single king. And that's the goal of it, is to release every single king.
Chwathpalak was hoping to have a fish wheel running for the first time in 25 years. The working group passed a motion in support of allowing fish wheels on state waters. Federal in-season manager Brian McCaffrey shared details on what's hoped to be a small social and cultural harvest opportunity of about 1,000 kings total. He says it would be on a per capita basis for 31 of the 32 eligible communities. Each village would get a dozen to several dozen kings, but Bethel would not be proportional to population and may receive around 100 kings.
Our primary goal again this year is conservation, and we want to give people an opportunity. We'll hope to work with the Tribal Council here in Bethel to find a way for them to provide community opportunities.
But the run has to be strong enough to support that limited harvest. To gauge that, and considering this year's early breakup, the Bethel test fishery will be starting a few days early, around the 27th. And just days before the run hits in earnest, managers are worried about two weirs that are hanging in the balance. The villages of Tuliksak, Kwikluk, Akiak, and Akichuk signed a letter saying if they can't fish for kings for a period during June, they would break contracts for operating the Tuliksak and Kwikluk River weirs. Steve Miller is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
But we're hoping right now that we can resolve that and get a contract in place. But we're required by law to conserve the fish on this river. That takes data. Those two systems are the only two systems on the lower river, and our plan is to operate both weirs.
The group passed a motion supporting the operation of all the river's weirs that count escapement. The next working group meeting will be at the call of the chairs. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska's Marijuana Ballot Initiative has some Fairbanks entrepreneurs organizing in hopes of being able to grow and sell the drug. Proposition 2 would have the state regulate marijuana like alcohol. Fairbanks resident Brandon Emmett is executive director of the recently formed Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation.
To kind of be a voice for the Alaskan people with the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board and the legislature, both for people who are consumers and people who look to profit off of the industry.
Colorado is the only state that currently allows sale of recreational marijuana, and it's taking in tax revenue on the business. Washington State is in the process of implementing a similar program, and Emmett says if Alaska goes that way, his group wants to be ready to help fill out legal details.
There are certain provisions of the bill that state, you know, persons over 21 can use. They can obtain a certain amount of plants in their home, but all of the time, place, and manner of different establishments, what the advertisements can be, how these establishments can be run, none of that is really set yet. So our coalition is really the next step.
Emmett and a few partners want to get into the marijuana business. So does fellow Fairbanks resident Mystique Lockery. She's not a member of Emmett's coalition, but has a plan.
My business is going to be called Mystique's Marijuana Dispensary, Nursery, and Supply. I have thought it would be really fun to open up a little section of it and have a smoker's club, similar to cigar clubs.
If Prop 2 is approved by Alaska voters, the state will have 9 months to hammer out provisions for implementing the marijuana law.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. BP Alaska, as part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
The village of Iklutna is now protected as a special area within the city of Anchorage. The Anchorage Assembly unanimously voted on Tuesday to create a district to protect the 800 acres that are considered to be the oldest continually inhabited Athabascan site in the region. KSKA's Ann Hillman has more.
The crowd of about 50 gave the council a standing ovation when they approved the new zoning law.
And that carries unanimously.
Mr. Chairman.
The purpose of the new designation is to preserve the rural character and cultural uses of the native village of Aklutna. It also allows community members to build multi-generational housing on single tracks for extended families and to build community smokehouses. Much of the debate over the new zoning area questioned if the municipality was giving too much power to a corporation. Assemblymember Amy Dembowski worried that giving Aklutna's native corporation power to refuse utility easements could create a damaging precedent. She proposed an amendment that would have given the corporation the right to a 30-day notice for the easements, but not an automatic ability to prohibit them.
It's challenging for me when I look down to the future and I say, for the first time in history, we're given a corporation veto authority on a local government. I absolutely respect the corporation. You are never going to find another better steward, better neighbor than this corporation. But what I am saying is I am not willing to give away the city's power at this point, no matter how great the neighbor is.
Aklutna Inc., the native corporation that's associated with the village, has given the city land for green belts and utilities. They've also leased land for schools at only $10 per year. Ultimately, the assembly, including Dembowski, voted to approve the special zoning area without the amendment. Member Tim Steele said it was the right thing to do.
Are we taking a risk? Sure. Are we doing something novel? Yes. It is respectful. It is about time. And, you know, we haven't always done things right. And I remember site condos. But this is right. This is a good thing. And I have a good feeling about it.
Curtis McQueen is the CEO of Aklutna Inc. He says the designation will help preserve the history of the area for future generations.
And we are so appreciative of the statement that the Assembly made today, because we acknowledge culture through museums, we acknowledge culture through Heritage Center, but the real museum is the village of Aklutna. And today a statement was made that the city of Anchorage appreciates and recognizes everything that Aklutna has done for the community, and they paid it forward today by recognizing the village.
The village of Aklutna is located northwest of the Glen Highway and is bound by Cook Inlet. Most of the current utility easements run along the east side of the highway. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
For the past 3 years, a British woman has been trying to travel around the globe using only her own strength. Sarah Uten has biked through China and rode the Pacific Ocean. Now she's in the Aleutian Islands, tackling some of the world's wildest seas in a kayak and learning plenty along the way. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
When she first left London in 2011, Sarah Uten couldn't have known that her journey around the world would lead to this.
If you don't want to eat, you come around and you just snag them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you go between them and jerk them.
Uten's standing on Korovin Beach in Atka, a village of about 70 people in the Aleutian Islands. That man giving her fishing lessons is Danny Snigaroff. For the past few days, he's been teaching Uten and her kayaking partner all about the traditional foods that line Aleutian beaches.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you, you have a triple hook nowhere.
A triple hook?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Whoa, no!
You don't have one of these, I'll give you one.
Thanks, Danny, that's really kind.
That could come in handy over the next few months, as these women attempt to kayak through the entire Aleutian chain, from Adak to Homer. They know it's been done before, at least in part. Traditionally, the Unangan people traveled through the Aleutians in kayaks. Uten says there have been more recent trips.
But we've not heard of anyone in modern times doing the whole length like that.
There are plenty of reasons why that could be. Uten's kayaking partner, Justine Krigenvin, has no trouble listing them off.
There's rocky landings, there's not very many beaches, there's no people, so if something goes wrong, you know, our longest stretch without people is 250 miles. That would take us 20 days, even if everything went well, even if we're not sat around waiting for weather, which we're likely to be. So, you know, there's just so many potential things that could go wrong, I suppose.
Sarah Uten, the explorer at the center of all this, knows what challenges lie ahead, but she prefers to take things
bit by bit in piecemeal, because it is overwhelming to think of the whole thing in its entirety. I mean, it's complex logistically, financially, physically.
Uten is only 28. It wasn't that long ago that she was back in England, studying at Oxford, rowing on the crew team, and dreaming of adventures.
I had no experience whatsoever of rowing across oceans. I certainly had no money. I was just a student at the time. And during that kind of early phase, just a few months into those ideas, whilst still being a student, my father died very suddenly.
That inspired Uten to row across the Indian Ocean alone, a record-breaking trip that set the stage for this journey around the world. It was never supposed to lead to Alaska. This time last year, Uten was trying to row across the Pacific Ocean to Canada.
The weather had been crazy, as you guys who live up here know that it can be really crazy and unpredictable and fickle.
That meant changing course. When Uten arrived at Adak in the Western Aleutians, it had been 4 months since she last saw another human being. Uten was sick and tired. In Atka, a week into her kayaking run, Uten still isn't 100%.
My face looks rather red at the moment. It's all allergies, so I'm coming back into contact with people and dust and animals.
But it's worth it. Uten says new friends and new experiences are what this journey around the world is all about. That's clear as the adventurers get ready to leave the village. They're packing their kayaks on the beach when the buzz of engines fills the air. It's more than a dozen residents riding down on four-wheelers to say goodbye.
So glad that you made it to Africa.
Yeah, so are we. Yeah, that was great. We had a really lovely time. Mike, I realized I didn't say cheerio. Fine, Andrew.
Mike Swetsoff is an elder, and he says he has to hand it to these kayakers.
You got some balls to do something like this. Be adventurous, I guess. I don't know. It's just not my thing.
Taking on the entire Aleutian chain is scary, he says. But Swetsoff and a lot of other elders in Atka think it can be done. With enough respect for the weather and the sea and an open mind, anything's possible. Reporting in Atka, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Lauren Rosenthal in Atka. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project.
If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.